Hello and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, the show that everyone's talking about but no one is listening to. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey all, I'm Mike.
I'm Dylan.
Hey, I'm Nick.
And I am Sam. This episode is being recorded on April 10th, 2025. Today, we are discussing Princess Mononoke, in particular the new IMAX 4K 8K restoration. And with that, Hashin. So, recently, last few weeks in theaters, there has been this theatrical release, re-release of this remastered Princess Mononoke. As everybody I'm sure knows, is the 1997 movie by Studio Ghibli, directed and written by Hayao Miyazaki, with all the usual Ghibli suspects being involved. We're gonna spoil the heck out of this, but like, everybody who's listening has seen this before. If they haven't, well, please go atone for your sins and go watch it in some format or another. Did anybody not see it in IMAX?
I unfortunately don't have the access to major urban areas y'all do, so I just was rewatching it on Max, unfortunately.
Yeah, you streamed it?
Yeah.
And was it the restored version then?
I'm not sure, but I feel like it must have at least been restored from the last time I saw it in a theater, because certain scenes with digital compositing, not to mention those like Miyazaki first-person flying scenes, the CG wasn't as jarringly taking me out of it as I remember it being when... Every time I've watched it before, from like a fourth gen fan sub in 1999 to seeing it in the theaters the most recent time I did, like sometime I think before the pandemic.
I'm surprised you didn't watch it on like Blu-ray, because I thought you would have had a Blu-ray version.
Oh, I do have a Blu-ray version. I'm just not sure. I am pretty sure it's not the most recent way I've watched it.
Huh, interesting.
I would assume whatever is streaming on Max is probably the Blu-ray master, which is okay. Like, I own it, and it's fine.
Sure.
Yeah, my Blu-ray is the old Disney one, too, so I figured the newer G-Kids master would probably be better.
Yeah, I guess it'd be interesting to see comparison, just bitrate limitations alone. It seems like it might introduce some stuff. But
yeah, there were certainly... a few moments where, you know, it at any bitrate below max, it's not great, but at full bitrate, it was decent.
Okay. Right, so that leaves the other three of us. We all saw it in IMAX.
And I am jealous as hell of y'all.
They're still showing it in my theater, like, I think this week, which is kind of crazy. It's got, like, a new poster image on the website, which actually looks pretty awesome.
Is it the new one with the mask and the forest in the background? Yeah, I've been seeing that one around my area too.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So I just want to say, first of all, nothing to do with this movie. I finally realized the stupid IMAX pun. It's IMAX. You sitting in front of this thing and it just like fills your vision. It's like your IMAX. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that until now. I feel kind of dumb.
I didn't realize it until you said that.
It especially makes sense for the original dome format, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so I want some opinions on the IMAX stuff in particular. Let's start with Nick. What did you think?
I mean, I had I can't think of a single complaint. I at first was slightly concerned because I got my tickets pretty early. I would say probably only maybe 8 or 10 seats were pre-bought by the time I bought mine. And I was probably I want to say 8 rows up, slightly off-center to the left. And at first I thought it was too close, but, you know, once I, because it was one of those, you know, recliner chair setups, once I put that all the way back, it actually was perfect. It was like, almost like exactly perfect for my full field of view. So from a viewing experience, it was immaculate. And then, you know, I don't get to go to theaters much just because my wife and I usually just are too lazy to, but this one ended up being a solo trip just because she had other things to do, and she was fine with me going because she knew how much it meant to me. So, man, the also just getting to hear the audio in that format was a real treat. Oh, I would say borderline that almost outshone the video remaster for me, almost.
Yeah,
just, I can believe that. Wow.
I mean, this score was made for a big, you know, massive audio system like that, just because, like, there's so many heavy bass strings and drums. Like, you really need a proper, you know, full range system to really catch that dynamic range. But
yeah, some of the tracks I couldn't help but compare to when I heard them live at Fanime in 2018 or 17, whichever it was.
What I can say is, I think I'm the only one in the Kenzoku that actually got to see this originally in 97, because I was in Japan in 97, the summer of 97 when this launched. And
lucky.
It was, I know, I'm kicking myself because I actually had, I saved the movie, the ticket stub, but I was using it as a bookmark, like a dum-dum in high school, and all the text rubbed off.
Oh no.
So it ended up just being a paper stub. But,
it's real, I swear.
I mean, there's no reason for me to flex. I remember thinking at the time, like, just how this, you know, when I said the last episode, Ranma 1/2 was a formative thing, this is probably the singularly most formative piece of animation for my entire life. And seeing it in the IMAX form for remastered, like, I was borderline tearing up for, like, half the movie just from how amazing it was to me. So, yeah, let that glazing be enough to describe my experience.
I did want to riff on your comment about the audio a little bit, and that I also, like, really appreciated the audio, but not so much for the music, but just for, like, all the sound effects and everything.
Oh, yeah, the audio engineering for this movie was just immaculate. I mean, when Ashitaka draws the arrow and you hear it tightening and straining, and then he releases and that whistling, you know, that it makes, just all the audio engineering for this.
The rain pattering on the rocks and the ground. It's just so good.
And the Kodama slowly starting to ramp up their clattering, until it fills the entire, you know, theater. Like, just, I can name a million different minutiae that just blew me away.
So,
To think if this was the first Ghibli movie with Dolby Digital or if that would have been Whisper of the Heart, but either way, they put a lot of attention to the soundtrack in a way that I don't think they had with, or the sound effects in a way that I don't think they quite had with the Ghibli previous movies.
Yeah, that might be true. Dylan, what was your experience like?
It was awesome. I was, pretty much the same of all the things. I had a nice center of the screen seat, and showing at my Buffalo, New York IMAX was, it might have been, I don't know if it was 100% sold out, but it was at least like 95% sold out. Yeah, it was just every seat in there was taken.
It was probably about 80% for me, and that was only because it was a late showing. Like, it was a 9 o'clock showing on a Sunday night, and it was still about 80% full. Only like the front rows were open, but otherwise the whole theater was filled.
Wow.
Wow, mine was pretty sparse.
Haven't seen that in a while for a showing that late.
It was awesome. They did a really nice job. I haven't, like, watched any stuff on the remastering arc, but it's one of those things where it's that good remastering where it just looks the way you thought it always looked, like, in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
At least for the, I'm hoping the IMAX mastered, like, doesn't have some of the obvious upscaling that the streaming master does, but even so, the upscaling on the streaming master looked better than I remember it looking.
So, I can't comment on upscaling or not, but I do have some complaints. It's just, my main one is, while it is a gorgeous movie and the restoration, the quality is gorgeous, I just don't think it's not a movie that's made for IMAX in that kind of format where your face is up against the screen. And so that was a bit disorienting. So like, the main complaint just being again that like your face is just locked in right at the very center of the screen. And the other thing that kind of sucked was that you see detail that you're not really intended to see normally because it's designed for a normal film theater. So there were parts of the movie where stuff like in the center of the screen was extremely blurry. Like when Ashitaka comes upon the field with the guys, I don't know what you call them, like raiders or whatever.
The samurai is raiding that town.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see in the center of the screen, there's action happening, but it's in the distance. And so like, there's very little detail and it's pretty blurry. And I think that's more of just a artifact of the original photography of the shot.
Yeah. I feel like those blurry shots are probably digital compositing and they don't have the original elements. So I think the only thing to be done with them is upscale.
Yeah. Well,
could be wrong.
I had assumed, this is Mike, where you know way more of this than I do. I had assumed that they would have just gone from like a laser scanning film stuff instead of.
Well, yeah, but the laser scanned film, you know, was printed at 90s quality technology.
Hmm. Oh, I guess that's true because originally because the movie itself went through a digital process to be made. I hadn't considered that.
Yeah, so you can tell the lower resolution in all of the shots that used digital as opposed to just. For compositing as opposed to we're able to get everything through a traditional cell animation style.
Oh, well, the curse of that new digital era.
Like, that transitional phase, yeah. Because this was very, very early in that transitional phase of
animation. Yeah, it's not like animation, quite so. As apparent as it was in going back a little further Memories and Ghost in the Shell, but it's definitely still in that era.
I mean, I will say, other than the stuff like the low res stuff, which again, just because of the format being IMAX, it really stood out at times. It wasn't there all the time. It still looked really good. Like the quality of everything was still fantastic. I didn't. Again, my only complaint is that it was too big and. But it was still really good.
I actually liked that. At first, it was overwhelming, but especially when it got to more midpoint, where a lot more takes place in the forest, it really was more immersive for me. It felt like I was being immersed in the forest and like being surrounded by it. I actually thought it was good. But I do agree, in the early part of the movie, say up to the point where Ashitaka runs into Eboshi's... survivors off the cliff. I do agree. It felt like I was like just, you know, a little bit too close. But after that, when it, you know, pivoted more to being within the forest itself, I actually preferred the IMAX experience at that point.
I think that probably aligns with my feeling it more in that like I didn't really notice it as much past that point either. Like I think there were probably times when I did, but for the most part, it was fine. And another thing was the CG. I'm always a stickler for CG stuff, but it's been so long since I've seen the movie originally. In this version, at least, it was really good. Like, I couldn't tell stuff was CG.
I feel like that had to have been redone or upscaled really well.
The vast majority of the CG like even before this, I do agree it was hard to tell. But my understanding was the vast majority was still rotoscoping. Like, you know, especially the early part with like Ashitaka's arm, definitely rotoscoped.
Yeah, I don't mean that. I mean like the obvious CG landscapes for certain shots are very apparent.
The only thing that I remember about
used to be they are less now.
The only thing I remember that was obvious, like there were certain like multiplane movement things that were like. Seemed pretty clearly CG, but
for me it felt like some of the like the plant growth stretching scenes ones where I was like, okay, this is a thing. The rest of it, like, there's stuff you're like, okay, this was done that way, but it's done in a way such that it makes it, you're like, I am not taken out or I feel like I'm looking at CG, you're just like, no, I'm just looking at the film. It's there.
Yeah, yeah, that I would call that like the morphing stuff. I did that with the rotting boars as well, which is not, it was not great. But it wasn't terrible, right? Like it was still somewhat tasteful. It's not like somebody threw like a full 3D CG character in there or anything like that.
Definitely not that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is interesting how extensively they use CG and digital compositing, especially compared to, because before this they'd done almost nothing. I guess they probably used some for On Your Mark, but the main ones I know are the Library Pan in Pompoko was their very first, which makes sense because I can't imagine animating panning across bookshelves would be much fun.
Was this at some point in Ghibli's history? It might even be this one that they started using Disney's CAPS system. This is something I meant to look up before this episode, but I didn't have time. Because I think Disney had this system they used for their late Renaissance things like Tarzan and stuff. And I think as part of their distribution deal, they gave Ghibli some access to this stuff. But I'm totally pulling that off the top of my head, and so don't take my word for it.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
Nor do I, but it could definitely be a possibility for sure.
I'll have to look into that and put it in a future episode.
So I have a question for the other two, Sam and Dylan, that saw it in theaters this run. Were there any obvious first-time watchers in your viewings? Like people who were pretty clearly seeing this for the first time?
I think so, yeah. I can't.
Well, I only say that because for those unaware, this is... to be fair, I haven't seen Boy in the Harem, but Mononoke Hime is, in my opinion, comfortably the most graphically violent Ghibli movie ever made. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where I chuckled because there are a lot of younger, like UCSD students. I mean, there are a bunch of UCSD students. I think that might be. They're all young-looking or wearing sweaters, but... The scene where Ashitaka gets to the raid, where the village is being raided, and, you know, you're seeing people getting... Suddenly he says stop, and he, you know, the very first time he draws his bow and fires and, you know, literally takes off, the, you know, this guy's two arms.
Yeah, he gets the four arrows.
Yeah.
There, I'll augment the language a bit, but there was a very audible "Holy crap!" when that happened, because I don't think this some people were ready for the intensity of this movie, which I actually reveled in because, like, I was incredibly jealous that this was the first time some of these people got to see this, because what an experience that must have been for them. This was almost a running gag for many years, but, you know, very famously, Princess Mononoke was really supposed to be Miyazaki's final movie. He announced his retirement during the production of it, and that's why Japan was really, really amped. It was like, oh, it's going to be his last one, it's going to be his best. In my opinion, it is, but obviously he continued to do even more movies after this than he did before it, by quite a lot, actually.
I forgot I was going to make that joke in the beginning, that he announced his retirement and he never made another movie.
I mean, to be fair, the situation at Ghibli, the landscape at Ghibli was different back then. I think he had a lot of successors in mind who obviously didn't pan out, and he feels a huge burden of responsibility to keep making, keep the studio success going. But by and large, I get the strong sense that he poured every iota of effort into this movie to make it the best thing he could possibly make, and, you know, walk away into the sunset having made possibly the greatest animated film ever.
Tell that it was meant to be a capstone work.
Yeah, it feels like it, right? Like, you know, I famously said I just have not cared for Ghibli movies since this. Not to say there aren't good ones after Mononoke, but just everything up till Mononoke, to me, even trying to take my nostalgia bias away, just felt more refined And I feel like a lot of the ones after Mononoke, with a few exceptions, I think I have a bit of a negative bias towards HAL, but I know a lot of people love HAL. Howl's Moving Castle. That was for a lot of people, that was a very formative one for them, and I get it. But I feel like after Howl, it's really been downhill, and just it, they all a lot they just feel way more, I don't know, like cookie cutter Hollywood style movies to me. That's my
I'll be
opinion.
more harsh. I will say I don't get Howl. Like I think everything after Mononoke is, granted, I haven't seen The Wind Rises yet, but everything
I
else.
enjoyed
When
The Wind
Wind Rises
Rises.
and Boy and the Heron, I have not watched yet, so I don't want
I
to be ag
need to
absolute.
see Boy and the Heron, yeah.
But if any of his movies deserve an Oscar, any of them, absolutely, Mononoke Hime should be the one that has the Oscar, because to me, like comparing this to Spirited Away, it's like not even close. Like Spirited Away is fine. But it blows my mind how many people like espouse just what a fantastic movie it is. And to me, all I see is really bad CG for some of it, and actually a lot of it, and then an otherwise decent Miyazaki attempt. But like compared to this, it doesn't even it's not a comparison in my opinion.
Well, I mean, what I wanted to say was that from Mononoke afterwards, aside from Wind Rises, which I haven't seen, they're very incoherent, like movies. Whereas Mononoke, watching this, for me, this was a super treat because I haven't seen it since it originally came out, or out in the States, and I watched it on like DVD or whatever. Or no, I originally saw it on a fan sub VHS, and it was. I had forgotten so much. Like I couldn't remember how it ended. Like I didn't know how any of this stuff was gonna go. So like it was almost new to me. Except I remembered about all the violence and the some of the major beats, and I walked out of being like that was a really amazing plot. It was very coherent. Like all of the actors had like their own agency in it, and it made sense. The different competing factions, what they were going for.
And it was super gray, right?
Yeah.
There were not
Yeah.
too many abjectly perfectly good or perfectly completely bad characters.
Yeah.
Like they all were very comp. I mean, I saw a fantastic article. I wish I brought it up on Eboshi, and like what a fantastic character she is, because her development through the whole movie, right? Like at first you're like, oh, she's the one that's destroying nature. It's all her fault. And then you see her city that she found, and it's she's literally saving all of these women from brothels and enslavement. Like, she is not a bad person,
Yeah.
just abjectly, right? Then you see like, oh wow, she's actually really noble. And then you kind of see she's kind of in cahoots with the imperial, with the crown, so to speak. And she kind of has to be, right? If she wants to, be given resources. So it's a very, especially for Ghibli, it's a very, I would say, like a lot of complex series of relationships, and
Yeah.
ultimately the res even the resolution at the end is far from a happy ending. Like
Yeah.
the whole purpose of it, like nobody got what they wanted. Like
Yeah.
the guardian deity of the forest, of the last of the ancients, so to speak, was gone. And the emperor didn't even get to
Yeah.
get the head either, because he just gave it back. And at the end, Jizo was just like, "Well, them's the breaks," and he just kind of shrugs. I'm like, "Wow, if I was him, I would just be so irate," because like, eh,
Yeah.
stuff happens. And I was like, "Wow, it's it, again, just yeah, I completely agree with you with your take, Sam. It
Yeah.
not a second of this movie feels frivolous. Not a second feels wasted." Such a great story, start to finish. Again, I can glaze this movie for eons, so feel free to stop me whenever. But
Yeah, there have always been some parts of it that drag a little for me, but I can't think of a thing I would cut.
at the same time, it also doesn't have the resolution of San and Ashitaka going off in lovey harmony, and Ashitaka is never allowed to return to his home village.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't get to do that. He's just like, well, I'm gonna stay in Neo Irontown, and I guess I'm gonna
Yeah.
do
Well, I mean, that was
that.
determined at the big, pretty much at the beginning, right? Like, he basically gave up his rights at the very beginning.
Yes, but at the same time, you feel like, okay, we'll get the happy ending or whatever, and he and San will go back to his village and he'll be allowed to return. And they're just like, nope, nope, you don't get that.
That's one thing, element I adore about it, is that not everything is storybook Disney happy ending. You know, that's what I love about the title in the title too. It's Princess Mononoke. It's like, oh, she's a princess, she's gonna be saved. It's like, no. She does not need saving. She does most of the saving, actually.
Yeah.
And she, even at the end, she's like, she straight up tells Ashitaka, like, hey man, you're cool, but I still despise humanity, so I can't live with them. I'm going back to my forest. And he's like, yeah, I get it. You know, Yaku and I will come visit from time to time. And that was the resolution. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much how it has to be.
I did like that, though, that like you say, it's not a clean resolution. They also didn't, you know, they didn't have to die or anything like really terrible, kind of over that's the true. Top like
you
that.
You know, like, I was trying to find a description for this besides saying this is Miyazaki's opus. Honestly, given their relationship, this is Miyazaki's end of Eva, really.
Yeah.
Like, this is the closest he'll get to making a movie that is has a kind of a disaster ending, I would say. Obviously, you know, the burden he bears is different than Anno's. So, you know, Anno can literally make the world burn and it's okay. Miyazaki, I think, has to think about the image of Ghibli. But I feel like this is very analogous to being his end of Eva. He poured everything into it and it shows.
Yeah.
And it came out the same year.
It sure did.
Oh yeah, that was
yep.
What a year.
That was a hell of a year.
That's true. I did want to point out that as a reference point, this is the same year in the US that Jurassic Park Lost World came out. So, like, just to frame what was going on in the US at that time, that was kind of where we were at.
Is that the second or third?
As the second one.
I think.
Second one.
As a complete aside, one of the things I wanted to say, because I remembered it, was for the original home release of this in the US. It was scheduled because it was the first one that Disney had the partnership with Ghibli, and they were going to release it on DVD. This was something 2000, by this point it was something 2002 or something like that, or one. And I remember because it was at Anime Expo at the Anaheim Convention Center. I'm pretty sure it was that one where I think they were only there for like a year or two, but that basically Disney was going to release the home video version without like a Japanese audio language track on it or subtitled, because they didn't even understand that that was a market that existed. They were like, oh, what? And it was something where it was like over, like someone got wind of it and basically at Anime Expo over a period of like less than a day, basically got like 10,000 signatures of people saying, hey, don't release this without a Japanese audio track. And they got it to Disney and they were like, wait, hang on a second. How long did it take you to get these signatures? They're like, a day. And Disney was like, oh, give us a second here. And hey,
I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and I remember because I was there, and I think my name was one of the ones that was signed on a thing. I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Not going to release a subtitle track.
And that wasn't even probably the biggest controversy between like Disney and Ghibli for this IP, because I think Disney was under the impression that Miyazaki was going to make another Totoro or another Kiki's, like a very, let's call it, Disney brand movie. And then when I can only imagine the abject horror in the eyes of the Disney producers who, when they first got this screen for themselves, were like, we cannot put the Disney name on this. This is way too violent. Like, the main poster is of the titular character with her face covered in the blood of her mother wolf. Like, we cannot market this in the US is probably what they were thinking. And it definitely was what they were thinking, because at the time, I believe, the story's kind of been told in different formats, but the gist of what I recall is that Harvey, it ended up being thrown into Mir- well, it got launched as Miramax because Disney didn't want their name on it. And also, Harvey Weinstein, the notorious Harvey Weinstein, was intending to actually edit out quite a lot of the movie to make it a little bit more accessible. And when that caught the ears of Miyazaki, he basically got incredibly angry and said, if you touch a second of this film, I will immediately withdraw all rights to it. And
well,
so that was...
already had his most personal work to that point, Warriors of the Wind, did, so
yes.
I can't blame him.
Yeah, and I completely agree and glad he's stuck to his guns, because, yeah, you can't edit this. Like, there's no editing this movie. I can't see it.
I didn't know this story. I think we mentioned it before we were recording, but there's a guy who was involved in this, an English guy who wrote a memoir, and he recounts a story of the producer Suzuki going to meet Weinstein at a meeting, and he brings him a replica katana, basically, and then he gives it to him, and then he shouts very loudly in English, Mononoke Hime, no cut, because he gives him this sword.
I heard it with a note attached saying remember no cut, but either way there's some variation of it, and some versions attributed to Miyazaki, but I believe in some interview Miyazaki cleared up that it was definitely Suzuki.
Yeah, this...
but also that it definitely happened.
Yeah, this is from this guy's, I forget the guy's name, it's on Wikipedia, the guy's name whose memoir it's from. But yeah, crazy times. I didn't realize also that Neil Gaiman did the adaptation script, which was wild.
Yeah, this is a film that I saw many times in, I think, in English. I've probably seen it in English more than Japanese. Part of it was that for a while at the local theater by the college, for whatever reason, when it came out in the US finally, it did so poorly. I still remember going to my my local theater in my hometown and seeing it.
Yeah, I saw it at the Rio. Where did you see it?
It was at the Rio, yep. The theater was kind of falling apart at that point. It was like, I was there, it was like nearly opening day or something, and I was like, there's like three people in the theater, and they didn't even have the, like, the people that were running the place were so high, they didn't even have the film, like, in focus.
Oh, God.
I'm not shocked by...
Yeah.
The late 90s UA wasn't in great straits,
but
is my recollection.
But then at the collegiate local theater, they ended up having it at a like a half off Wednesday night thing, and I think we ended up going and watching it like every week for like a quarter or two.
Oh wow!
Yeah, we just like we're like, oh, just go watch it. It was like cheap entertainment. It was like, I don't know, back then it was like less than $5 a person or something like that. Like.
How full was it every time?
It was at least like 10 of us that were there, and maybe a few others.
Okay, wow. So it was just you guys.
Yeah, it was, but that was enough to keep it running.
It was you guys, just you keeping it
alive.
Yeah,
just us. Yeah, we just kept it going. I keep rolling it back. As long as you're going to play it, we'll keep showing up every week.
I'm surprised the economics for keeping a print work that way, though I guess there aren't the costs for shipping it.
It was already there.
Yeah.
Like,
I remember... toward the late 2000s when I had asked the manager of, I think, the Fremont, like, what they needed to break even at that time on renting a print, it was like 100 to 200 seats, so,
wow.
Sales, so. But I'm sure the economics are different if it's not a one-night-only show.
Well, and if it's older, too, if it had been in the theater a while.
But yes, the original English, so I have seen it quite a bit, and it has some weird stuff in there where, Jigo, the monk, he describes something, and he's like, oh, this tastes like super donkey piss.
Oh, Billy Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same...
Right, that was that, this gruel tastes like hot water, is how they translated that part in the more recent translation.
Yes, that's a more accurate translation. He just basically said, it was commenting on how thin it tasted, probably because they're trying to, you know, ration.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, on the dub, some of the voices in the US dub are awesome. Like, They have.
Oh, they got some huge names in
there. Yeah, they got. They did get a lot of good voice names when they did it, because I think as well they were like, well, let's see if we can make some money. And they didn't make any money off of it, but it also kind of established, okay, we'll have this with name brand people.
And also, and by today's standards, like superstar voice actors, like John DiMaggio voiced Gonza. He's Bender in Futurama.
Yeah, and probably my favorite is they had Keith David as Oko.
Mm-hmm.
Oko. Yeah, and he was awesome as Oko. He's an excellent, a superstar voice actor.
I adore Keith David. He's a legend in American voice acting, like, absolutely.
Yeah, and he did such a brilliant job there, where I'm like, I kind of prefer his performance as Okokoro to the Japanese one. It's so different, too. It's also...
Well, yeah, the Japanese one, he was a decrepitly old man in the Japanese rendition of
it's
right?
Very...
To be fair, that's what he was. He was a very, very old, old god.
Yeah, so. It's very different. So I think this has been a huge tangent, but... I forget how we got
They also fell. Here. They fell victim to the. Well, I don't know victim, but they picked some big names who were famous actors, but not famous voice actors, and
right.
That's how you get the worst performances.
It's always that hard judgment between people that are Chris Pratt versus people that are not Chris Pratt in your films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you it's like you got a balance between the good voice actors versus names that people know that will draw them into the theater. Which is, I'm sure, that they're hoping for.
Yeah.
So, I think, Dylan, you had asked that, and I don't know if maybe Nick said he knows. What the heck does Mononoke mean? What is a Mononoke?
It's an old term for, like, things that dwell in the forest. So it can cover a huge range of things, including just regular animals, as well as more, like, almost supernatural creatures, such as the Kodama would be referred to as Mononoke. So basically, it's all of the creatures in the forest, kind of even the big, the large gods were mm-hmm. coined as Mononoke. So the term Mononoke Hime literally means princess of those creatures. And it kind of makes sense since this, her story is that she was like an abandoned human child that ended up being raised by, the last wolf god. So, but yeah, it's a kind of a catch-all term. It's not meant to be particularly nuanced.
Sure, it's kind of like yokai kind of thing, right? It's like...
Yeah, almost identical to yokai, except I get it has a more of a connotation of forest inhabitant versus, like, yokai can be,
right.
From any number of biomes, let's say. But
this is like
so that's
Nushi in. See an anime and stuff all the time, like the god of the mountain, the god of a lake, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. those kind of things.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess since there is no transliteral, this is one of the very, very few titles of Ghibli titles that did not have a completely different title in English and Japanese. Like just some example. Well, I guess that's not true. Some are identicals, like transliterals. Like, for example, My Neighbor Totoro is Tonari no Totoro is more or less exactly My Neighbor Totoro. Mm-hmm. But like Kiki's Delivery Service, the Japanese title is Majo no Takyubin, which is like the witch delivery girl.
Yeah.
So Wind Rises is pretty much exactly the same. Ponyo is the same. Howl's Moving Castle is pretty much the same, but that's also based on a book, so I don't count
Nausicaa
it.
Nausicaa is pretty much the same, but then again, that's not Ghibli.
Spirited Away, completely different.
Well,
it's
yes.
It's
kind of.
Well, the title, it's longer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Sen to Chihiro no Kamikakushi.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the spiriting away of Chen and Sen and Chihiro, which is very clumsy to say. So Spirited Away is a cleaned up version of that.
I'm surprised they went with that, to be honest, because like it is kind of a weird title, like Spirited Away. Like I'm surprised they didn't. I mean, maybe that by that time they realized they shouldn't try and over Americanize stuff.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I'm glad they did though. But...
Yeah, agreed. I'm glad they didn't really touch Mononoke Hime too much. They just let it be, and that's fine.
Porco Rosso is the same, but that one also isn't.
No. Porco Rosso is the red. The Kurenai, it's Kurenai no Buta,
oh,
which is the
gosh.
Crimson
Pig.
Well,
I'm so terrible. Never mind. I don't know anything.
Yeah, so, Pompoko. Pompoko
I mean,
is
Porco
Pompoko.
Rosso is also the Crimson Pig, but you know, different language. Yeah.
Was actually, it's about 50 pages. Yeah, Mimi Osamasaba is literally more or less Whispers of the Heart. So in general, I guess they've done an okay job translating the titles. So because obviously, you know, it's hard to not everything has a one-to-one, right? So
yeah, mouthfuls don't work quite as well in English for whatever reason as titles. Not that they don't try lately, but
I will say that Princess Mononoke, Mononoke Hime is kind of a lie is maybe not the right word, but it's a little deceptive. Like, she is a character in the movie, but like, it's not really about her, and it's better for it, right? Like,
that's actually, I'm glad you brought, I was going to talk about that, because unlike every other Ghibli movie where the titular character is the one that's followed, she is a main character, but the movie is about Ashitaka, right? Like, Ashitaka mm-hmm. is the main character, and obviously he interacts with Sun a lot.
Yeah. But
she's in the movie probably no more than, like, Eboshi or, you know, other, I would say, you know, named characters. So,
yeah.
I thought that was kind of a cool... I remember when I watched, I was like, why is it called... Why is she the titular character if he's the main... And then I got over it because it's so amazing.
Why? Because it feels like the movie's title, like, the literal English, you wanted to have it be like Prince Ashitaka's journey in the land of Mononoke.
Yeah,
you know, that would be like the long version of it, but it's not that. So why is it Mononoke Hime? Why isn't it?
I mean, we can get into the more esoteric discussion of why. I think my theory is that as a character that connects the bridge between the old and the new, she is like that one character, right? Like, she's the human raised by the wolves. And so even though she comes from this new era of man taking over the forests, she still clings on to the old gods, so to speak, right? Because they're saying, like, when the gods die, they're all of the progeny become dumber and dumber to the point where they end up just becoming food for the humans, because it's becoming the era of man, right? That's kind of like my take on it.
Hmm. You can almost change it as well to have the title be like Mononoke to Hime or something like that. If you almost like took a break between Mononoke and the princess part, that you do kind of get this thing of like, oh, here's all of like the forest creatures, and then here's this, you know, princess, I guess, for Hime. But
yeah, it's funny that normally as a shorthand we'll just call it Mononoke, but now that means something else because there is actually a show and movies of called Mononoke.
Right.
Yeah, true. I mean, and this movie continues to do what Miyazaki has always done, Ghibli has always done well, which is just make such tremendously capable, competent, and powerful female characters and having them be completely believable, like not and without it feeling like it's pandering.
Yes.
Right? Like, look at Eboshi. Look at Sun. Like, you can tell that how capable they are, and it doesn't feel forced whatsoever.
Well, and like, the cool thing about Sun is that she's dumb. Like, she's a very strong female character, but she's also...
She's hard-headed.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's flawed, for sure. She's incredibly stubborn.
Yeah.
Like, to the point of recklessness. Like, she literally assaults Eboshi's fortress with a spear and a knife.
Yeah.
And while literally they have guns, like... like hundreds of guns, and she's just gonna go one-on-one her. It's like, yeah, that's not very smart.
Yeah.
But still, obviously, you know, the point is her role is to be a likable, right, like defender of the last, you know, the last hope of the forest.
Right, right? Like you say, she's the bridge between nature and man.
Even though what's funny is that most of the creatures in the forest don't really make themselves seem very likable in the movie.
No.
Like, when you think about it, like, Moro is cool, but honestly, like,
I mean, Moro is almost literally a lone wolf that's like, I'm defending the forest, but I'm doing it for myself, and
yeah, and she even admits that she intentionally dodges the Shikigami because she knows that the next time she sees the Shikigami, she likely will die because she's like, I've lived too long, and he will probably take life from me, and I don't want to die right now. It's like very, you know, direct, and, you know, I don't want to say selfish, because not wanting to die isn't selfish, but also when you're a god wolf that's lived for centuries. You probably, you know, shouldn't be around much longer. And to be fair, she, you know, she definitely gave herself up and by far was the most impactful of the old gods in stopping the human, you know, overthrowers. Like, I mean, she got the near killing blow on Eboshi. So
I love the different, the kind of the sense of desperation between the different tribes of beasts, where you have like the wolves and the monkeys and the boars. And they're all like, they all really sense this kind of, hey, this may be the end for us. And so we're going to try really hard to like do something about it, but they're all like doing their own way. And they're like, the monkeys are like, hey, you guys are ruining it for us. And they're like throwing junk at them. And they're like trying to plant trees, like kind of stupid and futilely. And the boars are like, you know, oh, we have to do something. So we're going to go, you know, bum rush them. And Moral was like, you know, you're stupid. You're all just going to die. And they're like, yeah, we know. It's very interesting to like see each group's different approach and their, how they kind of clash and it still support each other.
I have a theory about that. Yeah. As you remember. So, you know, I said earlier that like the humans are trying to eliminate the old gods because once they eliminate the gods, the progeny end up, the you know, end up become, each generation gets less and less capable, dumber and dumber, mm-hmm. right? So I feel like with the apes, like you never really saw a giant ape, right? Like they were all relatively normal size. So my theory is that the apes had already lost their god, and so they already were in that spiral of becoming more useless. So the best they could do was just plant trees and throw rocks because they had already, I've been losing their powers, so to speak. And with the boars, like, Okotonoshi was ancient and very, very, you know, already kind of far gone. So I think that was an indicator why the boars also seemed a little bit more feral and bestial than the wolves. Like because there were only three wolves, right? There was Moro and then her two wolves and then Son. Mm-hmm. That was it. That was the wolf clan, right? Yeah. The clan was literally three wolves and a person. But they were also still the most controlled, like, and that's, I don't know, lack of a better term, like, intelligent.
Right. Right.
Creatures left aside from the Shishigami, who quite literally was just was quite literally just God of Death.
Yeah.
So, I did want to pivot just going back to specifically for a sequence that I really just was so glad to be able to like observe in the remaster. Pretty much, what I'm talking about is when Ashitaka enters Eboshi's fortress.
Mm-hmm.
Till he gets revived by the Shishigami, that whole sequence, like, I'm willing to bet is probably where they put the vast majority of, like, the, let's call it animation efforts, because every cut is just so good, and you get, it's just, in the story, in the flow, everything is just so good. Like, you get the fight, duel between San and Eboshi, which is quite literally probably one of if not the greatest fights in all of Ghibli movies. And then, you know, Ashitaka intervening and having to go into his, you know, tentacle god mode, so to speak,
so cool.
And getting shot and then literally, you know, opening up the gate barehanded. And then, you know, basically, riding till exhaustion until San wakes up. And then she takes pity on him. And there's like even a little bit of a bonding moment between her and Yakko.
Yes. Because
she sees that while he is technically, air quotes, enslaved by Ashitaka because of the barding, and she takes it off, she lets him go, he just sticks around, right? Like, he's not leaving Ashitaka behind, and she gets it. That's when she gets it.
Yeah.
And then she's like, you know, hey, come here, I want to save your master. And then, you know, she goes through the whole, that scene in the forest where she sets up the little, I guess, offering to Shishigami, and then he comes down and like he steps and you see the plants grow underneath him, then die. Yeah. Like, I was just like, god damn, seeing this in 4K, that was one of the sequences where I was just like truly, truly giddy, because I was like, this is how this movie needs to be, you know, observed. And then, you know, obviously it goes through and Ashitaka is now alive a week, and that whole that whole sequence to me was just like so immaculate.
Yeah.
In a movie that's already excellent, like from the entering the fortress till being revived, like that sequence of the movie to me was just like peak.
And it's like sound wise, it's masterful in my opinion with the way that when she brings him in and puts him down on the shore. I believe like from that point, it's like completely silent.
There's one of the very few scenes without any background music. It's just her dragging him through the lake, and like you only even the like minutia of like her cutting the stem. And then, you know, planting it. And it's just the detail, like, when she cuts the stem, you see the Kodomo appears and, like, kind of, like, ponder where she just cut because they're, like, the forest guardians.
And then you just wait in silence for the Shigami.
Yeah, and the only other noise you hear is when he steps, you hear the plants grow, and then when he takes his foot off, you hear them dying. Like, that's the only other noise you hear.
According to Wikipedia, the movie had, say 144,000 cells, 80,000 of which being keyframes.
Miyazaki checked and corrected him personally.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
The interesting thing too is like that he seems like he kind of started really doing this heavily in 94, after which is finally when he finished the Nausicaa manga, and that it was kind of this ongoing process of like script writing and storyboarding and then turning it over for animation. So they say that here that like final shots were completed like less than a month from the release date. So it was kind of like they just kept going and doing stuff. It wasn't as much of the I'm trying to think of someone who has a it feels like it was almost like coming out as a story or something as it was being developed, rather than some of the ones where it's like, oh, no, I have this whole thing took me forever. Like, I think Satoshi Kon goes more that way of being like, no, I have everything storyboarded out ahead of time at like a professional quality manga level detail.
I mean, one thing that I saw while doing a little bit of reading up about this is that he's been basically kind of playing around with this idea in his mind since like the 80s. And when he sat down to make this movie, he basically like wrote the script and did the storyboard simultaneously, like straight through, like just like he was just right there and not didn't like think it up ahead of time, just kind of as he did it, which is kind of wild for something so coherent, again compared to like all his other later movies.
Yeah, coherent with all of the nuance of the different characters and everything there. I also think I was thinking back just now on the talking about like, you know, talk about all of the other animals getting, you know, like they say, like weaker and dumber as time goes on. And there was the same comment that was made about the Emishi. Before he leaves saying, oh, you know, like our clan, like we're getting like weaker.
That's a good point, because Ashitaka was like gonna be their next leader, and he had to sacrifice himself to save the village. So it was literally the strongest in the village having to sacrifice himself to save it. That's actually fantastic comparison.
Although it is kind of interesting, and I don't know if it was intended this way, but like there's no real reason he had to leave other than that was their custom. Like they were kind of cutting their nose off to, not to spite their face, but you know, like,
wasn't technically, he chose to leave because the soothsayer, whatever her name was, the oracle, I think, Hisama, as the ancient, the old one, as they named her, basically gave, you know, said, hey, you know, what do you want to do? And he says, you know, I want to find a cure. And that meant, he knew what that meant, is that, you know, that's was you know, permanently leaving the village.
But
he understood.
He also said though that he knew that he was permanently going to be exiled as soon as he shot his first arrow at the god to try and save the village.
Maybe it was kind of like you have a choice, but you don't have a choice, kind of a thing.
Yeah, kind of.
Like you have a choice, and your choice must be to leave.
Yeah, it's like, well, here's your choice: either you don't do anything, and this crazed god comes in and kills us, or you shoot the thing and then we kick you out. But yeah, it was But also, it's kind of like, you know, as they sit there looking across the generations of the Amishi there, you know, saying like, oh, well, we're getting dumber and weaker as time goes on. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, but you're great, Ashitaka. But kind of like, no, you're like, you're obviously, you have to then be the dumbest and the weakest of all of us. It's kind of like, man, that's harsh. That's a harsh reality.
Yeah, that is rough. I didn't think about that. Kind of sideways insulting him.
Yeah. You're like, also, your dad sucks.
So we're coming close to the end here. So I wanted to give folks go around and get a chance to get any last thoughts they had about this movie. So, Mike, why don't we start with you? Any last thoughts?
Well, it's definitely a post-Nausicaa manga and also a very post-Cold War movie. Like, I'm not sure that this would have been made in anywhere near the same resolution before 1991, let's put it that way.
Okay. It's an interesting take. I had other cliche, even more cliche thoughts about the film, but I'll spare you those. What about you, Dylan? Any other parting thoughts?
It's a brilliant film, and it's still my second favorite film of 1997. Because I go back to the end of Evangelion well, but it's also one that doesn't make you it kind of in some similar ways it kind of like you said like it kind of makes you question your life and everything, but in a more cohesive way than End of Eva does. But it's
way more accessible.
Yeah, sure. It's way more accessible. It is not a film that I'm like, I'm selective about who I recommend it to. And I'm like, you.
Well, on top of like, that, the prerequisite to EOE right. is having watched 26 yes, exactly. episodes of a TV series as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, it should be. That doesn't mean you have to, idiot.
But
by which I mean myself.
at any rate, it's brilliant. Yeah, I think the scene with San on top of the roof before she does her suicide charge, like that cell print there, it might be like one of the best, my favorite like anime like cell things. I'm not gonna call it a cell, but a frame or whatever that like has been done. Mm-hmm. It's so good. It's just, it's fabulous. Yeah. That's all.
Nick, how about you?
I don't know what else I can say that hasn't been said. This is anime notwithstanding, just as far as theatrical length movies, this, it's hard for me to not give this the top spot, but at worst it's in my top two.
Mm-hmm.
This is a desert island movie for me. Like I have an irrational, almost an irrational attachment to it at times. I intentionally avoid discussing it because I know I'm very biased towards it, but having watched it again, I'm so glad to, I feel partially validated because, you know, it got this very unexpected and, announcement of a 4K, you know, IMAX run. It was very, you know, very surprise announcement, and I was mm-hmm. so glad that it was done. I wish it has a longer proper run, but at the same time, hopefully that just means G-Kids actually releases this remaster on home disc sooner than later, because whatever editions that they release, I'll just find the most premium version and immediately pre-order that, because, you know, I have to own it. And this movie may be the reason why I finally upgrade my home sound system to something that isn't just like a sound bar and a subwoofer. My wife might say otherwise, but you know, we'll have that discussion. But yeah, it's still great. Almost 30 years later, it's still my favorite Ghibli movie. I wouldn't say by a huge margin. Whispers of the Heart is also one that I hold very dearly, and Laputa as well. Castle
yeah.
of the Sky. These are the three of my Ghibli Mount Rushmore for sure. The order is likely still Mononoke first, but again, not by a ton. But in any case, yeah, very obviously his greatest work. You can see in the efforts, and
yeah,
I'm glad that a new generation of people have a chance to see it for the first time.
Yeah, I echo everything you all have said. It's a masterpiece for sure. And after having seen it again, I would say it's probably even underrated. I think a lot of people don't rate this movie highly enough. It's super good. I think people should, I mean, if you've ever watched Ghibli stuff and you haven't watched this, like, man, you're missing out. If you've ever watched animated stuff, like, and you haven't watched this, everybody should see this movie. It's so good. So anyways, rather than blabbering, I'll just stop there. So next time we will be discussing the last film in our Satoshi Kon film series. We'll be watching Perfect Blue. So go find a copy of that and watch it, and then listen to us talk about it next time.
Perfect Blue was also had its original film festival release in 1997.
Are you serious?
Yep. The theatrical release, man. The theatrical release in Japan was February of 98, but it did have a film festival release in August of 97.
Like, we'll count it. I mean,
yeah,
that's
crazy.
It counts
too.
For being that,
yeah,
the winning year of 97. So, all right. So, until next time, this is AMO Kenzoku signing off. Sadaba.